But today it is VE Day. The war is over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Marx Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
And Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Marx Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show. My name's Jeremy Gordon. I'm the still relatively new editor of Citywire Wealth Manager, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by two of our reporters, Sophie Downes and Natalia Vasnier. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Today, we're here to speak about some of the biggest stories in wealth and asset management this year. Although, expect less of an exhaustive list and more some of the big stories that the team have enjoyed working on most in 2025. Sophie, we're going to start by talking about UK banks and wealth management. This is a theme, a topic you've written about quite a lot this year. But maybe the first thing to say is that compared to many countries, UK banks aren't really that big players in the wealth management space. But people think that will change, right?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So if we look to Asia in particular, really the big players are the banks and wealth management, whereas the UK is a lot more fragmented. You sort of have your IFAs and your smaller wealth managers. So I don't think this will change drastically anytime soon, but we have seen a real shift this year in the way UK banks are scaling up their wealth offerings. So if we look to one in particular, I think HSBC has probably been the most vocal about what it's doing in the wealth space. So we had the launch of their Premier brand at the end of 2024. And this has all been about delivering kind of a high-touch Premier service that appeals to the mass affluent clients. And in 2025, we've seen the bank really build on this through the launch of these wealth centres, which are essentially these kind of luxury meeting spaces, huge in Asia, but also a reduction in fees. They've lowered investment thresholds. So this is all in aid of really encouraging more mass affluent clients and into the offering. And we had Christopher Dean, who's been sort of leading HSBC's wealth proposition this year, on the podcast earlier this week. And he said it had been a roaring success.
Okay. And then Lloyds and Schroders Personal Wealth, that seems another interesting thing to touch on here. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think it's important to say, you know, that we are saying there's a big opportunity here, but entering the wealth space needs to be done incredibly thoughtfully, I think, and this really encapsulates that. So this year we saw the collapse of Schroders Personal Wealth, which was essentially the joint partnership between Lloyds Bank and Schroders. And when it was launched, it seemed really sound in theory. It was relying on client referrals from Lloyds and the wealth management expertise of Schroders. However, it encountered a series of problems after launching in 2019. So it saw Brexit, COVID, and a series of tech issues, actually, which meant the platform was only launched this year. So what does this mean for the wealth sector? Well, it kind of feeds into this banking push, really. It's set to rebrand as Lloyds Wealth. And they've been incredibly tight-lipped so far on what this will mean going forward. But it is an essentially watch this space. So we'll likely see more in 2026.
Okay. I'm afraid I've got not one, but two questions for you. Why are banks doing this? Why are banks doing this, firstly? And also, whenever we write about this, it gets a lot of interest from our readers. Why do you think that is?
I think really the advice gap. There's a lot of people out there who have savings and yet aren't accessing advice, which means there's a real opportunity. And I think people are very aware about this. So, you know, even if banks might not be the biggest players in wealth management, they still wield a significant amount of influence. So everyday consumers will know your Barclays or you'll know your NatWest, but you might not be familiar with Raymond James or Rathbones. So if these banks are really serious about driving their wealth proposition, getting people in, they could garner a significant market share in the mass affluent market. So in theory, this could mean less business for wealth managers.
And do you think that's why our readers are so interested in it?
I think so. I think it's in wealth managers' best interest to see what the banks are doing, much like they'd watch any competitor in the space.
And Sophie, this year you've worked a lot around like the FCA. You've had them in twice into the studios. What has the regulator been up to this year?
A lot, to answer it simply. We had Nick Heumann in May and Nikkei Trost and Sarah Woodruff in October to discuss targeted support. So I think there's two things that spring to mind here. Firstly, when Nick was in, he said the regulator had been turning mirror on itself and wanted to focus more on regulating for growth as opposed to risk. So this kind of excessive safetyism of the regulator has been a constant topic on people's lips this year. I think the second part to this is there's been a real drive led by the government to get more people investing. So targeted support is expected to drive change here, and this will allow firms to give predefined, ready-made suggestions to groups of customers without the cost and complexity of full individual advice. So the regulator released final rules last week after receiving industry feedback. When it goes live in April, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in practice, I think.
And do you see targeted support as a silver bullet in getting more people to access financial advice?
No. So I think as much as it will be a helpful part of the puzzle, the regulator has been clear that there will be trade-offs to this. Firstly, it's not personalised, so there'll be limits as to what firms can actually suggest to clients. I think, you know, we won't see it across the full continuum because for smaller firms, they likely won't be offering it because of constraints on resources, costs, etc. So again, it remains to be seen in practice, but I don't think this alone will be the golden ticket for supporting people into advice.
Well, staying on the topic of the FCA this year, some firms have come under scrutiny from the regulator, and a big story for us this year was the FCA restricting Harry Redknapp's backed Dowgate from taking on new clients. We noticed from the FCA register that the wealth manager and the stockbroker, Dowgate and Dowgate Capital, had been restricted by the FCA from taking on new clients and receive an asset allocation restriction, which meant that without prior consent from the authority, it was not allowed to dispose or withdraw from any of its own assets. I think this was a really interesting story from the headline because of its link to former Premier League manager Harry Redknapp, which owns about 0.4% of the business. And many shareholders of the company are also involved in the sporting world, which includes Saracen's owner, Nigel Ray. So I think this has been kind of a bit of a big topic this year as well.
What were the reason for these restrictions?
That's a pretty interesting question because when it came out, there was no clear reason behind it, but I was kind of digging up into the FOS complaints that were upheld against Dowgate, and a big topic was the lack of communication advice towards the clients when it came to investment risk. So there was two clients that filed in complaints for the lack of financial advice that Dowgate gave them, which led to a huge dropping in their investment portfolios. One of the clients saw a dropping in their investments of 30%, which was pretty considerable for them. So as I was mentioning, Dowgate has been one of the biggest stories this year for us, but there's been a lot of movements happening across the big wealth management firms too. What has stood out to you this year, Jeremy?
That's right. Well, I'm fielding this one, even though I only became editor of the site in October. So I'll do my best. I think, you know, we couldn't really kind of have a sort of bigger stories of 2025 without touching on what's going on at a couple of biggest firms in our sector. And we should say we're recording this on 17th of December, if I've got the date right. And yeah, Evelyn is definitely one to watch. This is one where what we're saying here could be overtaken by events. But yeah, so wealth and advice firm, about 67 billion assets under management. And the PE owners have been trying to sell it for a good couple of years now. And the news is really that it might actually happen. This is something that we've reported on, others have reported on, but a deadline was set for, after a long time trying to drum up interest, a deadline was set for bids on the 10th of December, so last week as we're speaking. And who's still in the race? Well, speaking of this theme about banks getting into wealth management or trying to expand, Barclays, I think, are definitely still in the race. RBC is a Royal Bank of Canada who own Brewin Dolphin. They're also still in the frame. And other names that have been mentioned have been NatWest and Lloyds. What else to say about this? Well, it's thought that the PE owners want a $2.5 billion sale price. What they get, we don't know yet. I mean, presumably they will be able to sell it to someone. But I think if this sale is a good outcome, for them, it kind of will be very much sort of game on still for private equity in our sector. Although, yeah, we don't know. They have been struggling to sell it. That much is clear. And I'll mention one more thing. Sorry. Another big firm, Canaccord Wealth, its Canadian parent company. And actually, there's a bit of private equity investment in Canaccord Wealth specifically too. Anyway, they've also acknowledged that there are some sale discussions, maybe quite exploratory, taking place there.
So expecting a lot of M&A in the new year then?
I think that remains a big theme in the sector, yeah, M&A consolidation.
And we've also heard that Rathbones have had a lot of reshuffling this year. Could you talk a bit more about what's been going on there?
I can try. So yeah, so I think so Rathbones, you know, sort of the biggest firm of its type in the sector, at least the biggest kind of standalone firm. You know, if you accept that, you know, SJP is a bit of a different beast. So yes, so Jonathan Sorrell took over from Paul Stockton as CEO over the summer. So who is Jonathan Sorrell? Well, his background is kind of Goldman Sachs, private markets, and then the hedge fund world. You've got to acknowledge as well, he's also the son of a guy called Martin Sorrell, who I think basically everyone will have heard of, but he was the architect of WPP. We, you know, in the media, where, when a new CEO comes in, we do often talk about shakeups and things like that. But I don't think there's any editorializing here. Like, I think there is a bit of shaking up going on. There's already been kind of at least four changes in the leadership team. And I think the question now is what is Jonathan Sorrell's vision for Rathbones? There was, you know, big merger with Investec, Wealth and Investment, a couple of years ago. Rathbones is listed, but it's quite lowly rated compared to some of the other firms in our sector. You know, the valuation of the shares isn't that high. And I think Jonathan Sorrell will want to get the firm growing again. And I imagine, you know, maybe in a way it wasn't with Paul Stockton, kind of everything is on the table, really. He might be willing to do some quite radical things to get the business moving in the direction he wants.
Okay. And then I've also heard that Raymond James and Charles Stanley, there's been some mergers happening there with the brand.
Well, yeah, we'll touch on that kind of very quickly. So Raymond James, giant wealth management firm in the US. And, you know, they've been in the UK quite a long time. And then I think it was 4 years ago was the announcement they were buying Charles Stanley, which is, you know, kind of old and storied name in the wealth management sector. And yeah, they've been... Well, it's been a turbulent few years, I think, but next year they are planning to kind of integrate the businesses more or less, the Raymond James UK Wealth Business and Charles Stanley. And our colleague Dylan has already had a few stories on that, actually, that restructure, creating a central investment office, a couple of people leaving, a couple of people promoted. So I'm sure there'll be much more to watch there. Okay, well, so something you've written about a lot, Natalia, is funds and fund flows. What have been some of the key themes there this year?
Yeah, so no, it's been a pretty exciting sector to follow up this year, especially so when it comes to UK domiciled funds. A big standout was Terry Smith's Fund Smith Equity Yes. Fund, which has had a really tough year. It's seen an overall $6 billion outflow in the year to date, pushing down the size of its fund to $16.9 billion. Which kind of pushed it out of its six-year reign as the UK largest active fund. Mm. Only a year ago, it stood at $23.6 billion. A big part of the story of these outflows is its continuous underperformance, which has led to kind of this big loss in popularity of the fund as well, with the quality growth stock picking style that it has. Yeah. And that kind of has fallen out of favour because it's been extremely hard for global equity managers to really outperform and ramp up returns in a market which is so US dominated at the moment.
Yeah.
It has also been a rough year for Nick Train.
Yes, another big name.
Another big name.
Who did brilliantly last decade.
Exactly. So his Lindsay Train UK equity fund dropped below the $2 billion mark, which was a pretty tough one for him as he lost around $1 billion in outflows in the year to date. Once again, it's another story of underperformance, with the fund returning kind of minus 2.8% compared to the Citywire sector, which returned 32.2%, which I think is
that over 3 years?
That's over 3 years, yeah.
Wow.
It's just a pretty stark difference. So again, there's been so much moves, a lot of outflows happening in the space, and a big one as well was the departure of Nick Kerridge from Schroders back in July, which kind of followed on from a few months before of the departures of Kevin Murphy and Andy Evans. Many investors, so through conversations that we've had with kind of wealth firms, including Tatton, the MPS provider, lost confidence in his Schroders recovery fund, which saw the largest outflow in August since July 2000, which was a pretty big thing for them. However, despite the outflows, performance has remained strong in the past 3 years. I know that, Sophie, you spoke to Simon Adler, who took over from Nick Kerrish. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so I caught up with Simon Adler in November, and actually the outlook was very positive. So he maintained that Schroeder's team was in terrific shape.
He's the new head of the Schroeder's
New head of value, team, right? Yeah. And so following the exit, he said the team was actually as strong as it's ever been. So there has been an undeniable focus on streamlining. The team has changed a little bit, and predominantly, I think, through the departure of two of the EM fund managers, so Vera German and Juan Torres. Both left the team, both very high-performing funds. But I think there's this focus on simplifying the structure and focusing on what the team is good at, was what Simon actually said. And there's also, I think, focus on driving the team forward. So a term that kept coming up during the interview was this desire to be deeply forensic in everything that they were doing. And one of the ways in which they aim to do this is through an increasing use of tech and AI. He didn't go into too much detail about this in practice, but I think that's the position of the team going forward. So, you know, after that period of internal change and the consequent redemptions, they do seem quite optimistic.
Okay. Well, so underperforming star managers, manager exits. Has it all been doom and gloom, Natalia? I think there's one firm you want to highlight which has been doing a bit better.
Yeah, no, absolutely. 2025 was a really strong year for Artemis Fundhouse. In the first half of the year, four of its funds featured in the top 20 active UK domiciled funds in terms of outflows, which was pretty impressive. Which is pretty impressive. Its most attractive fund was the Artemis Global Income Fund, which saw an overall 656 million inflow, pushing it past the 2 billion mark, making it one of the kind of important funds in the sector. I think it's worth noting that two other contenders from the Artemis Fund House was the Artemis Smart Gup European Equity Fund and its UK Select Fund. So yeah, overall, I think the fund space has been pretty interesting this year, with some pretty negative kind of stories for Fundsmith and Nick Train, but Artemis coming out.
It does show how it can turn around. I mean, only a couple of years ago, Artemis, you know, there were lots of outflows. People sort of thought, what's the future here? And now, you know, it's all seems to be going great.
Coming back to a story that really kicked off the year and we haven't discussed, and that is Saba's involvement in the investment trust sector. Jeremy, you covered this quite extensively. Can you give us a quick rundown?
I did. Yeah, I was previously leading Citywire's investment trust coverage. So yeah, who are Saba? They're a US hedge fund led by this guy called Boaz Weinstein, who is, what should I say? He's a big character and he says quite punchy things. Anyway, so what's the context here? So yeah, many investment trusts, so London listed funds had fallen to big discounts, you know, trading a long way below their portfolio and net asset value. This does happen cyclically. Rising interest rates was one reason, but also, you know, our audience, wealth managers, selling out of investment trusts for lots of reasons. So over the last couple of years, Saba built up big positions in many trusts, at which they bought the shares at big discounts, and the idea is that they want to profit from the discounts closing. So they did this, and then it was about a week before Christmas last year, they launched a campaign to replace the boards of seven trusts and actually take over the management of the trust themselves as the fund manager. That second bit was quite unusual, and it's fair to say people were pretty sceptical about it. It was a playbook that they'd used in the US, but it got quite a lot of people in the UK fired up.
Mm-hmm. Would you say it had been a success?
Would I say it's been a success? Well, they've invested very heavily in the investment trust sector. I mean, obviously they are trying to make money, but you know they are investing in the sector at a time when lots of people are leaving. I would say yes and no. It's been a success. I mean, we don't know how much money they've made, but you know, if you look at those original seven trusts they targeted in that high-profile campaign, which actually got a lot of coverage in the national press as well, unusual for investment trusts, they've had some kind of outcome or exit at four of the original targets. Now, some of those trusts, they might have done something anyway. You know, they might have taken action regardless of Saba. But I think one thing worth saying is that they've, of those original seven, there are two Baillie Gifford trusts and another investment trust called Herald, run by a very well-regarded fund manager called Katie Potts, where they still have a lot of capital tied up and neither side wants to budge. Now, will Saba kind of win a vote eventually at one of these trusts or another trust? Probably. So I would look for that in 2026, but I also think there's going to be quite protracted, some of the exits from some of these trusts. Okay, well, I think that's all we have time for today. So, well, I should say thank you very much to Sophie and thank you very much to Natalia.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. I suppose the last thing I should say is Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year from everyone here at CityWire. And please look out for more of our podcasts in 2026.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crown queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.